ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sesonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The last light of the sun is washing over the rooftops of Alexandria, turning them rose and copper. We're in Roman Egypt, and tonight, the city's elite, they are throwing a party. Long tables sag under the weight of platters of figs and pomegranates and honeyed almonds. Friends are laughing, and the wine, well, you know it's flowing.
So you've got to imagine like a court, a king, his family, and then a court structure where you have lots of friends and the king.
But these parties aren't just about booze and food. They're really about showing off. And one of the best ways to impress your guests is with gadgets that do all kinds of weird things, like
funny ways to pour wine and water so that your guest ends up with wine all over their shoes. Or there's little montages of birds that sound like they're whistling because there's water pouring in from a fountain and being pushed out through little internal pipes in the birds.
Mechanical birds that whistle, trick cups that soak your shoes in wine, tiny machines purely designed to prank wealthy dinner guests. But then there's this one invention that feels, well, at least in retrospect, it feels a bit more important. It's a metal sphere and it's spinning in the air. Below it is a cauldron.
So that when you heat up the water in the cauldron, the rarefied air goes into the sphere and makes it spin because the air is able to escape through those little pipes on the side. And so you're turning steam into movement.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that spinning ball might look like a party trick, but hidden inside it is the basic idea of the steam engine, one of the most important technologies in human history. But when it was invented, it wasn't powering trains or powering the Industrial Revolution. It was powering dinner party entertainment. And I guarantee you, no one saw it coming. On the western edge of the Nile sits one of the greatest cities of the ancient world. This is Alexandria, a place where cultures layered on top of each other, Egyptian, Greek, Roman, and for centuries it was one of the most intellectually vibrant places on Earth.
So Alexandria, as the name implies, it was a city that was set up by Alexander the Great, and then it was held by the kingdom of the Ptolemies for a long time. But by 60, the Romans are now actually in charge. And so you're left with a city that is incredibly complex, right? You've had the Greeks, you have the Egyptians to begin, you have the Greeks or Macedonian Greeks who come in, and then you have the Romans who come in on top of that. And the city is as diverse as you would expect. Religiously, for example, you have these blends of Egyptian religion, Greco-Egyptian religion, Roman cults that come in. You have a high Jewish population. You know, this is an incredibly diverse cosmopolitan city that has always been, since Ptolemy the First, who was the first monarch to reign in that city, really invested in intellectual culture. So we had the museum and the library that are set up very early in Alexandria, and that they continue to be really important institutions.
So this is the voice of Dr. Tatiana Burr.
And I'm a lecturer in classics at the ANU. So I work on the wonderful world of ancient Greece, and that's a period roughly from about 800 BC to about 200 CE.
And if Tatiana's voice sounds familiar, that's because she was on this show a couple of months ago talking about a wild ancient Greek computer that they found at the bottom of the ocean. And for reasons I can't quite explain, The conversation ended up with us joking about starting an indie band together, which has not taken off, but the history was excellent. And this time, we are venturing into the multicultural and kind of bougie world of Alexandria.
It's a really cosmopolitan city. So when the Greco-Macedonian elite come into the city, they are occupying most of the upper class, but they are intermarrying pretty quickly. We have evidence that then we get Egyptians who are occupying important positions in Alexandria as well. What we're going to talk about today, Mark, is really the kind of elite cultures that I'm describing. It's not something that the everyday person would have been able to enjoy. These big institutions were definitely a luxury that not everyone could access.
To be rich in Alexandria meant that your calendar was basically an endless cycle of banquets and festivals and religious ceremonies and dinner parties.
They would get together in various situations. One of those situations would have been dinner parties, let's say. They may or may not have had a religious element. They may or may not have been combined with a bigger city-wide kind of festival that had hundreds upon hundreds, not only of people parading through the streets in different costumes, but also animals. Elephants, tigers, people holding different objects, big carts that had statues that could move by themselves, or a scene that depicted a cave of Hermes. So we have these kind of really sumptuous occasions. And as part of that, you would have people who were intended to entertain the elite. And part of that entertainment came with showing off the kinds of things that the monarchs had invested in creating. And so science and kind of performance inevitably sort of went hand in hand in that sort of context.
Now, remember, Alexandria, it is an intellectual hotspot. You've got your libraries and research institutions, basically the ancient equivalent of academia, filled with scientists, thinkers, all trying to, as they still do today, get funding for their ideas. And if the upper crust of Alexandria society are constantly showing up to parties with both a bottle of wine and some new mechanical gadget, well, for those scientists, that looks a lot like an opportunity.
In fact, many of these scientists realise pretty quickly that for money to be invested in what they're doing, it's a good idea to make it snazzy, to make it a bit of a showpiece. And so lots of gadgets get developed and lots of what we now think of scientific developments get channeled into little objects that are actually quite playful.
And God bless nerds, many of them kept records of their weirdo trinkets.
So we have texts that describe 80 of these objects, and some of them are meant to be used at, say, like a dinner party or a drinking party. And they're everything from, here's a cup, Mark, hold it and I will fill it up. But as I fill it up, past a certain point, there's a little hole in the bottom that you haven't noticed, and it suddenly drains the liquid out on your feet. Or there's little montages of birds. So imagine a little setup where you have a running, like a fountain, that's running into a basin. And then that basin has like little birds that are dotted around. And those birds inside have little pipes. And so as the basin fills up, the air that is pushed out of those pipes makes the birds whistle. And some of them even, you know, they move. Or there's other ones where you have mammals that are given a little cup of water, and just a simple siphon inside makes it seem like that animal is taking a drink.
So mechanically animated through water or air, they could create this incredible movement.
Exactly.
There are dozens of these machines described in ancient texts. Tiny temples whose doors open by themselves. Miniature theatres that perform entire plays. Ingenious, beautiful, occasionally ridiculous. And behind many of them is one man. Hero of Alexandria.
Hero of Alexandria is one of our most prolific ancient authors on mechanics. So we don't know much about him, but we have lots of his texts. He writes on automata, which are self-moving machines. He writes on kind of more mathematical topics, like how to measure things. But he is of interest to us because he writes this text that has about 80 inventions that are all to do with using steam or air or fire or water in order to play tricks, to surprise or to amaze.
So it's a very boring book about some very fun things.
Absolutely.
And one of those fun things is a technology that would one day reshaped the course of history.
So within these 80 or so objects that I'm describing, there is one that gets translated as the steam engine. And this is an object that the description is pretty simple. You take a sphere, Mark, an empty sphere, and you have two pipes that are stuck on either side, the sort of L-shaped pipes. Mm-hmm. And then underneath you have a cauldron with water, mm-hmm. and you have another pipe that connects this cauldron to the sphere, so that when you heat up the water in the cauldron, the rarefied air goes into the sphere and makes it spin because the air is able to escape through those little pipes on the side. And so you're turning steam into movement, and that is why it gets called the steam engine.
Just for context, right? Like, when you visualize a steam engine, the kind that powered the Industrial Revolution, they show up in like the 1700s. That's about 16 centuries after Hero invents this thing. Like, nobody realized for 16 centuries what steam power could do, including the guy who actually designed it.
Hero doesn't use anything, any kind of language of the sort to describe it. He actually describes the object and says, oh, it'll work just like the little worshippers that I described that dance around. Because he has another object where there are, thanks to steam, worshippers that whiz around like they're dancing. So he certainly doesn't think that it's there to power any kind of engine.
So the very creator of this particular thing, or at least the sort of the credited creator of it, we don't think he could see the way this particular technology, steam-powered, could one day power things like trains and things like that. It's a technology in isolation.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's in isolation for us. It's within the context of all of those other gadgets, very much in the tradition, right? It's like another funny thing that I can do with steam, another funny thing that I can do with fire or with running water. But the interesting thing about this object is that the language that he uses to describe it is just describing, the setup of the actual mechanism, and he doesn't give much context of use at all. But it's not the first time that we, historians, let's say, are really keen to think that he had something bigger in mind for the object. He probably didn't. He wanted it to just be a fun party trick, but we're thinking, oh no, he definitely had like a train in mind that this could power.
This is a huge endorsement of messing around and making useless stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So, Hero, do we know anything about this person beyond the fact that they had a lot of free time?
No, we don't know lots about him. We have a lot of texts and we learn about him through his texts, really. But what we do know is that he was interested in all sorts of elements of mechanics. So he was interested in weightlifting. He was interested in describing self-animated machines, or what we might call robots today. They were called automata in Greek. He was interested in mathematics, but also very much in the practical side of mathematics that turned into mechanics.
But the most interesting stuff always comes back to how he leverages air and steam.
That's right, yes. He writes a text called the Pneumatica, and pneumatics is a beautiful word. It's the science of pneuma, or breath, and that's because we're using air, right, to power all of these things.
I promised myself I wasn't going to bring up our indie band that we did last time we did an episode, but Pneumatica is a great album title.
Yes,
right?
That is.
I'm just saying. You Perfect. Have to go back and listen to the other episode, but we started an indie band a few weeks ago. We're working on material.
The EP is coming out soon.
EP's coming soon, but Pneumatica is going to be the first single I've decided. So, Hero, by the way, are we going with Hero or Heron?
He's referred to as both. I call him Hero of Alexandria, but you'll also see it referred to as Heron.
Okay, so Hero, Tinkerer of the Ages, he creates all this stuff, but how is it found again? Or is it recorded and kept track of?
Yeah, so he writes these texts and they're not particularly beautiful ancient Greek. So they don't make it into like your curriculum, let's say. It's a pretty obscure text. It's a bit like reading an IKEA manual, you know, how to create an object and how to put it together, how to put your flat pack together for ancient times.
No, it's a perfect analogy.
And so he gets looked over for quite a long period. Mm. And then in the Renaissance, so let's say between like the 14th and the 17th centuries, he does start to be read again, particularly in places like Italy, where there's a court culture that happens again. And these objects seem to fit in perfectly, actually, with what some of these Renaissance courts are doing.
Wait, so we're going from 60 CE... and he doesn't really get properly revived until like the 14th to 17th century.
Yeah.
So can you imagine having your work kind of slept on for more than a millennia? That's insane.
It is. It's not unusual. I mean, there's this kind of, the Renaissance revives all sorts of elements of classical culture that had been looked over for a while. And the mechanical tradition, as I said, it's difficult to read. It's not particularly riveting. It doesn't have the beauty of some of the verse of, say, Homer or Ovid or one of these poets. But it gets picked up partly because of the court culture, but also because you do, around like the 15th, 16th century, start to get intellectuals who are working towards developing the actual steam engine, or what I should say, the modern steam engine, as we work towards the Industrial Revolution. And so at the same time as these texts are being read, you have thinkers that are kind of working towards improving the model or thinking with steam in different ways.
One of the big ideas of the Renaissance was this notion of revival. The belief that ancient Greeks and ancient Romans, they'd figured out extraordinary things and that for some reason Europe had just simply forgotten them. And so Renaissance scholars, they begin digging through all of these old Greek and Roman texts, and eventually, yes, they do discover Hero's work, which, as previously established, reads a bit like a 1,000-year-old IKEA manual. But in very oversimplified terms, these Renaissance types at some point go, whoa, this guy really cracked onto something useful to do with steam.
No, I think that's a lovely way to write that history, Mark. And I think the only qualifying thing that I would add is that we have in that process a kind of removal of the object from that really playful context that it was in originally. So, as I said, the Italian Renaissance courts were very happy to read this as like a fun little gadget that was meant to impress, because they saw the value in that in terms of the cultural value of having just an impressive intellectual kind of little object. But as soon as we move past the Industrial Revolution, the steam engine then gets kind of completely decontextualized from the fun element. And that's a shame, because I think that's a great part of the story, right? Of where it came from.
In other words, too often we forget that necessity is not always the mother of invention. Sometimes fun is the mother of invention. But just how easy is it to connect the dots from the spinny cauldron thing to the modern day steam train?
I think there is some connective tissue, and even if it is to look at this and to be inspired in a different way, I think that still, you know, is a valid reason. We know that, like, 1850, we get a translation in English of this text, and that definitely already calls it a steam engine. So whether that's kind of looking backwards, or whether that, you know, where that fits in the dots that you're kind of drawing, Mark, is an interesting point. But we stick with this label, you know, into the 2000s, scholars talk about this as the steam engine.
When is it that people realise that what Hero did was groundbreaking and 1,000 years before its time?
I think it was around this time, so around the 15th, 16th century, that people are looking back at this and going, huh, this is similar. Although it was kind of very quickly noticed that it didn't quite produce enough talk, like it didn't quite have the capacity. But this is interesting because it feeds into a narrative about the Greeks being almost there, but not quite as capable technologically as the modern man. So we get these stories very often that the Greeks, they were brilliant and they could have almost done it, but we've come along and we're just that little bit more brilliant.
See, it's interesting you say that, because I reckon I've come across that in the comparison between Greeks and Romans. It's like the Greeks kind of had all these great ideas, but the Romans were the ones that like really solidified it, made it viable. I feel like that idea reverberates through way too many history podcasts.
Absolutely. We get this idea that the Greeks were theoretical, that they didn't want to get their hands dirty, and then the Romans came along and they were very happy to build aqueducts. And that's, you know, where engineering actually comes from.
I just, like, through context clues, I am assuming that you disagree with this interpretation of history.
Yeah, I think, well, on the one hand, this actually...
Your arms are folded and you're like...
Damn straight I do.
Go and check out the video. I think on the one hand, this has been actually disproven, especially archaeologists have done a really good job of showing the various practical inventions that the Greeks had. Aqueducts are not Roman to begin with, by the way. They come from the East and the Greeks also use them. Anyway.
Oh, wow. You've just been you've been sitting on that one for a while, haven't you?
I finally got it off my chest.
Yeah. Who knew aqueducts would be a source of such frustration?
We know now that the Greeks were doing really advanced things theoretically, but also practically. That's not to say that the Romans didn't continue to improve those traditions. Of course they did. But there's also just a little bit of myth-busting that's gone on since about 1960 in terms of the history of technology. The Antikythera mechanism is a really good example of something really sophisticated that the Greeks actually could physically make, that they didn't just theorise about or write about in a text.
And if that's new to you, you should definitely check out Tatiana's other episode. It's a few weeks back. It's very good.
So there's that. But then there's also the baggage that came with assuming that the Greeks couldn't quite, you know, get their hands dirty enough to create stuff, which was that they must have had some other reason. They must have been blocked in some way. And the biggest reason that often gets given is that they had slaves. And so because they had an enslaved labor force that they didn't need to. And so there's lots of interesting debates that go on about why the Greeks were kind of blocked technologically.
There's like 14 different ways in which that doesn't
hold
compute.
Up.
Yeah, I was going to say, Romans had slaves. And in the 14th and 17th century, lots of the European countries had slaves. Some of them are more comfortable admitting it than others.
You're a great student in my tutorial, Mark. Thank you.
I'm so happy to be here. So when you look at Hera's steam engine, what is the story that it tells you about ancient Greece and progress as well, and then sort of technological progress that we sometimes choose to pay attention to and sometimes gets lost?
One of the things that I love about this story is that it brings us back to the priorities behind innovation. Why do we create new things? What kind of context do those new things sit in? And then when they get picked up and taken into new directions, was that the original idea or intent behind it? And so it's a good reminder that even some of the technologies that we're creating today, that we think that we're anchoring in a very specific circumstance or use, will be taken up and will be used in different ways. And so in this way, history offers us like a really lovely point of reflection. We're not learning from the past in a kind of blanket copy and paste way. You know, this happened before and it's going to happen again. But we're actually using our position now to look back and to think critically about how technology, culture, society interacted, and then be able to ask questions about our own kind of modern technological conundrums.
It's interesting because it's also a great example of how just because something was designed for one purpose doesn't mean it can't end up being used for another one completely. There's a lot, this is going to seem really nerdy, but there is a line from the movie Apollo 13 that has always stuck in my head, which is, I don't care what it was designed to do, I care what it can do. And when I look at this device, that's all I think of. It's like, it was designed for fun. It was designed as a trinket. But the fundamental mechanism, the science behind it would go on to power an industrial revolution that completely rewrote the world. Now, the connective tissue, you've got to bounce a lot on the map of history to get there, but there is a connection. And from a trinket that people used for fun to one of the most profound shifts in history is an amazing little saga in a spinny steam thing.
And one that probably no one saw coming.
That is for sure. Do you think if Hera had seen the steam locomotive?
Yeah.
Or the Titanic?
Yeah.
What he would have thought of that technology? Do you reckon he would have recognised? He went, oh, I had no idea you could use it for that.
Good question. I think so. He was a really curious mind. I think he would have loved to see the way, you know, the different directions in which this gadget was taken, for sure. But at the time, I think he was probably thinking that he was weighing in more into debates about natural motion, like how the body moves, or even possibly how like the clouds move and how clouds are formed, rather like he probably wouldn't have predicted that this is the direction that it would have taken. But that's not to say he wouldn't have been totally charmed and enchanted or horrified.
Ah, who knows?
Dr. Tatiana Burr, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Tatiana Burr is a lecturer in classics at the ANU, the Australian National University. And just a reminder, you can go listen to Tatiana's other episode. We will link it in the show notes. It was fun. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Angie Grant. And as ever, No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. As always, please get in touch with us. Tell us what you're loving. If you have a story, you'd like us to check it out. No One Saw It Coming at abc.net.au. And I am Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.